The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha. The Lotus Sutra is quite long, and it's full of beautiful and lengthy and vast descriptions. And it's tempting to skip over some of these, but there are jewels embedded in them, little phrases that make you stop and think, oh, that's interesting, and think about it for a bit. Little pointers to training. The descriptions, many of them are of various Buddha lands, full of people diligently training themselves in all kinds of ways and making offerings to their Buddha. Little pointers to how we train ourselves. These Buddha lands are not irrelevant to our own world. They're not really of somewhere else, some ideal place completely separate from us. And as we'll see later, our own world is a Buddha land, if we look at it in that way. It's not that we ignore all the suffering and misery that goes on in our world, but we can see it as a place of training and try to take everything that happens as something we can learn from. As Reverend Master Jiyu said, I must take everything that happens as being for my good. It's not that things happen just for our benefit, we can choose to take them in a positive way and still have a heart of compassion for all the suffering in the world. The Lotus Sutra has been translated many times, starting in the 3rd century, and now it's translated into many languages. One of the first translations was made by the great translator Kumara Jiva, translating it from Sanskrit into Chinese in the 5th century, some time ago. And this is the translation that most other translators use to translate into other languages. Kumara Jiva loved the Lotus Sutra, and that's probably why people particularly like his translation. It comes through. And this Lotus Sutra has raised innumerable questions for people, especially people who like things to be clear and consistent. The Lotus Sutra is not always clear and is not always consistent. So it's given rise to endless discussions and different interpretations over the centuries. Some people dismiss it as just an empty fairy story, an entertainment with no real content, full of passages about his own merits, in saying that it's the highest of all the Buddha's teachings, but where is the meat of it? What is this essential teaching? It talks about the merits of reading and reciting the sutra, writing it down, passing it on. And where is the actual sutra, they say? Where is this real teaching? In fact, there's plenty of teaching in it. A lot of it in the form of parables and metaphors, different from the way it's often done in the sutras. But the teaching's there. And all those little jewels of wisdom, as I said. So for a few people, they think, you know, well, where's the meat of it? Where's the sutra? And I thought that when I first read it. I thought, well, I zipped through it. I seem to have missed it. Well, I had missed it. For a great many people who are a bit more perceptive than I was then, it's a whole lot more than just an empty story. Great Master Hakuin, for example. Great Master Hakuin was a very famous Rinzai master, not in our tradition at all, known for his fierce training and his very fierce teaching. And he encountered the Lotus Sutra and read it when he was young. And he dismissed it as being irrelevant to his training. He thought it was just a collection of simple tales about cause and effect. So he just put it aside. But later on, at the age of 41, It sounds as though he's having kind of a hard time in his training, actually. So he picks it up again. After all these many years of training, lots of experiences and all that, nevertheless, he was having a difficult time. So he reads the Lotus Sutra again. And at chapter 3, he burst into tears. And later he said, "All the lingering doubts and uncertainties vanished from my mind. They suddenly ceased to exist. The reason for the Lotus Sutra's reputation as the King of Sutras was now revealed to me in blinding clarity. I knew without any doubt that what I had realized in all those satoris I had experienced, what I had grasped in my understanding of those koans I had passed, had all been totally mistaken." He loved the Lotus Sutra from then on, and he preached about it for many years. So this fierce old master who had been training all this time realizes that all his experiences have been mistaken. There's an interesting point here. No matter what we may have experienced, no matter how long we may have been training, we should never think we've reached the end, that we're enlightened and we don't need to do any more. We can't learn anything. Shakyamuni Buddha trained himself until the end of his life, going, going, going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. And Rav Master Jiyu said this over and over again: "You're never done. You're never there. There's always more to learn, always more to understand." So what had Hakuin seen that caused this? Well, he wrote to an old nun. He said, "Everything proclaims the Dharma principle, that all things are a non-dual unity representing the true appearance of all things. This is the fundamental principle of Buddhism," i.e., what it means is, everything is one thing, the unity of all things. Everything is Buddha nature. And that's what he saw when he read the Lotus Sutra. Everything proclaims this Dharma principle, that everything is Buddha nature. Well, we say this all the time, actually, well, quite often we say, everything is Buddha nature. But the Lotus Sutra might have said it first. And it was certainly the first time that Hakuin understood it. And he also says that you need not just self-effort, effort made by ourselves, but also devotion and faith, i.e. self-power and other power. And this is from one of the fiercest Rinzai masters who frequently made himself sick through his efforts in striving for enlightenment. He realized after all that you need not just your own effort, but also you need faith, other power. River Master used to talk about this, self-power and other power. Juriki and Tariki, I forget which is which. Self-power is our own effort. Other power, relying on faith. And you say that in Zen, it was like the two ends of the tunnel. You go in one end for Zen, self-power, making our own effort. And for Pure Land Buddhism, Shin, you go in the other end, through faith. But in fact, they meet in the middle. When you practice Pure Land Buddhism, you need to make the effort. You can't just sit back and say, "Oh, well, Amida Buddha will save me." And in Zen, we make our effort, and you need faith. It's vital. We start off making our own great effort, and that's good. Then eventually we see we need to ask for help. We need to rely on faith. If we think it's just up to me and my efforts, we're missing something. We're missing a lot, in fact. There is an arrogance in thinking we can do it all by ourselves. We take refuge in the three treasures. We need help. And we need faith, which is the basis of asking for help. You have to have faith that something will help you. To take refuge in the three treasures is to practice faith. The Buddha can help me. The Dharma can help me. The Sangha can help me. The Buddha can help me. Not just Shakyamuni Buddha, not just the scriptures, not even just the Lotus Scripture. Buddha nature can help me. And this isn't just taking refuge in our own heart, though that's a large part of it. It's being willing to listen, to know that we are just a part of something that's a lot bigger than we are. To listen, to hear that. And as I often say, because it's vital, it's not about you. It's not about me. Our training is not just about us and our views and opinions about it. It's a whole lot bigger than that. Everything can help us if we let it help us. Taking everything as being for our own good. Sometimes somebody says something that really helps us, maybe quite inadvertently. There's all these stories in the old texts about somebody hearing a song, a courtesan or a dairymaid or somebody is singing, just a kind of folk song, and it wakes them, you know. Or they meet one of those little old ladies who ask awkward questions and cut through their, you know, opinions. And the stories about peach blossoms and pebbles hitting bamboo and all that. And the person has to hear it. They have to see it. They have to be able to hear. And if they can hear it, it can help them. And if we're just full of ourselves and our opinions, nothing can help us. We need the willingness to listen, to let go of our own selfish views, to let go of our own past experiences, even our understandings and insights, as Hakuin did. We need to practice faith. It's not just up to me. I need to rely on faith as well. The Lotus Sutra, it's a work of faith, as I said, and it's hard to understand and accept some of it. There are descriptions of huge numbers of beings right from the get-go, this enormous crowd of beings, quite impossible really. And they're all on Vulture Peak, Mount Gridrakuta, where the Buddha did a lot of his teaching. And apparently, the space up there is actually quite small, and you couldn't fit more than, you know, 3 or 4 dozen people there at most. And certainly not all those thousands and millions of beings who were introduced right at the get-go, right in the beginning, all these beings, thousands and millions of beings on Vulture Peak. And billions more come later. So we know this is not to be taken too literally. And then there are the enormous eons of time. People have been training and making offerings to countless Buddhas. Kalpas of time, as numerous as the sands of millions of Ganges rivers. Well, this is quite impossible to our ordinary mind. Even our universe isn't that old compared with some of these huge lengths of time. Eons of time of training. Eons of time it takes to become a Buddha. It all sounds rather disheartening. But if we look more closely, we'll see that actually in the sutra, time is kaleidoscopic. Because then there are places where it says things like, everybody sits there in meditation for 6,000 kalpas. But the Buddha makes it seem like it's just an afternoon. So time is not what it seems. Sometimes it can seem like 6,000 kalpas and actually it's just an afternoon. Centuries later, when Taisho Eka asked Bodhidharma about these endless eons of time it takes to become a Buddha, Bodhidharma said, no, it doesn't mean that literally. Otherwise, who would ever start? It just seems like eons of time, but it isn't really. So we can be encouraged. And maybe we have already been training for eons of time. How would we know? Because it's said that to obtain a human body is a rare and wonderful thing. And to be able to hear the Dharma and put it into practice is an even more rare and wonderful thing. So somehow we have this opportunity now. We must have done something right. We must have planted good roots in the past. We must have done some training before this. Maybe eons of time, who knows? So we can take heart and not be too dismayed by these countless kalpas. It won't be us as we think of ourselves anyway. We come and go. And the training goes on. in the Lotus Sutra that a lot of Buddhas are introduced, all in their own Buddha lands, all with huge retinues. Everything's big. Vast numbers of bodhisattvas and other beings making offerings to these Buddhas and venerating them. And the Buddhas all venerating and making offerings to each other. There are lists of all the huge amounts of offerings that are made. Incense, music, flowers, robes, jewels, all sorts of things. And again, far more than one could comprehend, certainly far more than anybody could actually ever use. And interestingly, the offerings don't seem to stay around. They appear, and that's it. It seems like they kind of disappear again. It's the offering that's important. It's not the things in themselves. They've been neck deep in stuff, you know. And even very small offerings have great value, as the sutra makes clear. It's the offering, the veneration, the faith that's important, not the things. And especially this veneration of the Dharma, and particularly the Lotus Sutra itself, over and over again. It talks about the benefits of making offerings to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and the benefits of revering the Lotus Sutra and passing it on. It talks about this a lot, repetitively, you know. It really wants to make it clear that to venerate Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and to venerate the Lotus Sutra and pass it on, is really good. Demonstration of faith in the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, and faith in the Dharma and in the Lotus Sutra itself. The countless beings have come to hear the Buddha preach the Lotus Sutra. It's a special thing. This is the Lotus Sutra. Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come from all their Buddha lands, millions of miles and, you know, long, long way away, to hear him preach the Lotus Sutra. The bigger picture, this is what's demonstrated. There's something a whole lot bigger than we can possibly imagine. And this is why the Lotus Sutra has so many descriptions of innumerable Buddhas, Buddha lands, Bodhisattvas, and so on. So many descriptions of endless karmas of training, all these Buddhas with all their retinues and people venerating them for many, many kalpas. Huge. It's not to discourage us. It's to help us to widen our view. To see that there's something a whole lot bigger than we can ever fathom with our little mind. There's unimaginable numbers of Buddha lands and beings and kalpas, far more than we could ever encompass or grasp with our little brain. So we have to relinquish our grip on trying to fathom it all, to make sense of it all. In that way, and simply accept that there is far more than we can grasp with our little mind. Limitless time, limitless space, limitless numbers of beings. We can't possibly encompass them all. And that's the point. We could just dismiss it all as figures of speech, but we need to beware of the critical mind that judges and says, well, I can believe this, but I can't believe that. No one is asking us to swallow great lumps of things we can't understand and can't digest, as it were. But we can suspend our disbelief and just let it be. And to consider, what am I missing? What do I not see here? Maybe there's something here that can help me. Maybe I don't see it all, to put it on the back burner, as Mervamart used to say. Let it cook. And one day maybe it'll clarify, and maybe it won't. There's a whole lot more going on than we can see or know, and that's perfectly fine. This is what happened to great master Hakuin, the fierce old Rinzai master. When he was young, he wasn't ready for the Lotus Sutra, so it kind of bounced right off. Well, he bounced right off. He wasn't ready to entrust himself to faith. He was doing it by himself. I will make my effort. I'm doing it myself. And later on, he was ready for the Lotus Sutra. He was ready to understand. It's not just about me and my efforts and my experiences. It's a whole lot bigger than that. And he had the openness and the humility to say, I've been completely mistaken about everything. Really exemplary. I've been completely mistaken about everything after all that. You know, through faith, he was able to let go of everything he had done up to then and see clearly. To see, in a nutshell, everything is Buddha nature. We will continue tomorrow. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.